Okay. All right. So it looks like it's. It looks like it. Pardon?
Can you give me Jason's number?
Jacob. Yeah. Yeah. I will. Okay. I'll do that at the break. All right. So it's recording now. This is Cold Case Christianity, the fourth evening, and we missed the first three. So here we go. All right. So let's open in prayer. I can do it. Dear Father in heaven, thank you for everything. Thank you for the design and fine-tuning of the universe for our benefit. Thank you for the design and fine-tuning of all of life for our benefit. Thank you for the design and fine-tuning of your word for our benefit. So we ask, and the design of our minds so that we can begin to appreciate all the wonderful things you've done for us. So help us to open our minds this evening and to understand better how we might share all the wonderful things you've done with others. So bless us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Sorry, man.
Quite all right. Quite all right. Okay, so are there any loose ends? We've covered a lot, and so I wondered if there are any loose ends, either from the reading or from anything, or you're going to beg me for a hint about the mystery that I told you. I'll share with you the very last day to make sure you come. Remember the mystery that I've been sneaking in every class, a very powerful tool. But you have to read between the lines to get it. So, any questions on anything?
No, not at all.
Wow. Either that means I'm doing a very, very good job or very, very bad. I don't know. Okay, so I do have
a good job.
Pardon?
You're doing a very, very good job.
Oh, thank you. I have a few loose ends. I was remiss in something, and let's see what it was. Okay. On the left brain personality, we had a whole list of characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking in words, logical, cold, Mr. Spock kind of stuff. We had a whole list of characteristics that we could use in thinking about how to deal with people that happen to have a left brain orientation. We had the same sort of thing for the right brain. We had a list of characteristics, intuitive, emotional, thinks in pictures, artistic, fun-loving, that kind of thing. All right. So we had a whole list for the right brain, and it occurred to me that we don't have a list for the unconscious mind. And many could make the case that that's the most powerful part. I mean, without you thinking about it, it controls your heartbeat, your respiration. It's always watching everything you're seeing. It help you in numerous ways. It's absolutely pivotal for decision making. There's a whole book written on that, which I showed you the second time, I think it was, second class, How We Decide. So basically, it's very important to you, but I did not give you a list of characteristics. So here we go, list of characteristics, some of the key points about the unconscious mind. Okay, by definition, you can't directly access it. It's not the subconscious. The subconscious you can eventually get. But therapy maybe, but some way you'll get to it. But the unconscious you can't get. You can only sense what's going on with your unconscious. You sense it. All right. It is superb at pattern recognition. That's why the unconscious mind thinks in terms of patterns. It remembers stories. It remembers narratives. It basically is a pattern repetition machine, kind of. The more repetition, the better it remembers. And the more truth it ascribes to what it sees over and over and over again.
So what is the difference between the unconscious mind and the subconscious mind?
The subconscious mind, eventually you can get to. You can, if you think hard enough, if you have a help of a therapist, you can find out something about your childhood that you remember and it really affected you. All kinds of, it's things you can access. But by definition, the psychologists have said, by definition, the stuff you can't get at directly. You can only sense. That's the unconscious. Some of them call it the adaptive unconscious mind because it's changing all the time.
But the stuff in this unconscious mind, it does eventually rise
yes.
to the surface of
yeah.
the conscious mind.
Yes, yes. If somebody says something that is inconsistent with a narrative that the unconscious mind has accepted, and somebody says something inconsistent with a narrative like that, you'll get an emotional reaction. You might get angry. You might get a little bit anxious or something. You'll sense that something's wrong, even though you can't logically perhaps figure out what they said that triggers it. The book Blink, remember that was one of the references by Malcolm Gladwell? The book Blink talks about how it has kind of an instant reaction to some situations. And he has, in that book, given examples of how that works and how powerful it is. So if you're really interested in the unconscious, let's say the book Blink is very good, and the power of it is how we decided. The references were a previous handout. Okay. It's always watching. You can't turn it off. You cannot turn it off. You have no control over it. It does what it wants. All right? And it learns patterns faster and better than you. Psychologists, in some tests, it's 4 times faster. Some game where you have to detect a pattern to win the game, it'll actually know 4 times, and they do sensor things and understand faster than you. Your conscious mind will catch on. So it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And it trusts you. It's easily tricked by repetition. Okay. And the emotions send you signals what's going on. Okay, anytime something, you hear something that's, they talk about outside your comfort zone, the unconscious mind is in charge of your comfort zone. That's what gives you the uncomfortable feeling when somebody, or you try to go outside your comfort zone. So it's a very powerful thing, and I really encourage you to read about it. But we can use it even though we don't fully understand it. It's usable, and that's what we'll talk about. Okay.
Yeah, are you going to send this to us?
Yeah, this is all the overheads you get.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Every overhead that you see, you get the next day. Now, the reason I do that is I hope that you'll remember things I said
right.
when you look at it, and it'll help you exercise that idea of being part of a conversation, being part of a meeting, but also watching it, separately watching it, and recording what goes on. And so that you can analyze it. So that's one of the reasons to send you the overheads afterwards. You can make notes on them if you print it out or something, and recall perhaps what I said or what others have said about them.
I'm interested in the one point, the second one from the bottom, where it says it trusts you. It's easily tricked by repetition.
Yes.
But I'm curious about why the subconscious trusts us.
It's part of you, and it trusts that you feed it good information because it believes what you feed it. That's why it's so important to read the Bible every day,
right.
to help feed your unconscious mind. And it knows what you value by what you spend your time on and what you study and things. So it trusts your judgment, so to speak, because it's part of you. So that's why some of these ideas of daily devotionals and all that are really, really important, because you're training your unconscious mind. You're reading the Bible about
right.
the stories. You're learning these narratives, and it's seeing those patterns, so that when you're in a situation and it sees a pattern, hey, wait, King David got into that same situation. I mean, you might not consciously remember that,
right.
but your unconscious mind might see that pattern and help you by giving you either a comfort feeling or an uncomfort feeling and nudge you in the right direction. It's your conscience, basically, among other things. So,
Ray?
Yeah?
Where does intelligence fit in with regard to conscious, unconscious, and subconscious?
Well, intelligence is the whole package, ability
okay.
to deal with information and apply it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, basically, it's the whole package, your whole mind.
Okay.
Okay. And remember, the idea of using this model, this simple model, when developing strategies and tactics in dealing with various people. Remember, we said, okay, where is this person now? Well, he's kind of emotional. We want to get him out of the emotional up into perhaps the logical side.
Right.
And that so this is helpful. All right. So you can picture where a person is on this chart and then where you want to move them. Okay. And the point, the reason it's a loose end, the point I didn't make was when you ask a person questions, you're moving them to the unconscious because you answer things. You don't generally think of the exact words and then you say something. You just say it. That comes from your unconscious mind. All right. So when you're asking questions, you're moving a person to this area where they live, where their decisions are made. Yes, sir?
So if you answer, I noticed some people, when you ask them a question, they answer it immediately, apparently without thinking. Does that mean that they're just accessing their unconscious rather than...
The unconscious is helping them answer that question. And it's so things are coming to the surface, and they have no control over that. It just kind of comes out.
So if you're more thoughtful in your answer and you think about it a little longer before you open your mouth, then does that mean you rely more on your conscious mind?
Yes. Yeah. Basically, this person, this can say something that's perhaps inappropriate for the setting, mm-hmm. and that's where these things come in. In other words, very often a person will consciously dampen their impulses of things to say. Now, other people will, in a sense, shoot off their mouth no matter what. You know, if it pops into their mind, they'll say it, and without regard to consequences. So, yeah, there's a dialogue that can go on for a thoughtful person, that, especially if you're in an evangelistic situation and you want to keep that relationship and you want to build that relationship, you'll be very careful about what you say and use these faculties to help adjust what comes out. So, all right, so that's a great theory. Oh, that's wonderful and all that. Elaine, we were talking about it, and she says, you know, I have a big problem. And her big problem, and I wish she was here so she could better explain it to me. She says, I have trouble recalling granular facts. Like, when I'm in a situation, very often I'll revert to some science idea or something I get from science, because I like that and think in those terms. But she has trouble remembering the granular part. She's right brain. She's big picture, not so much the details. And so she has trouble remembering. And she said, I'm going to have cards with me on some of these things. I said, no, that won't work. That won't work. And also, she, because of her sensitivity to other people's feelings, she doesn't want to even come close to confrontational with anybody, not even risk it the slightest. So we're talking about it, thinking about it. One possible answer is tell stories. Nobody, there's no argumentativeness, this is what happened to my brother, or this is what happened to me. Just tell stories, remember stories. And that's a way to get around her particular frame of reference and adjust a tactic to her psychology, basically. And that's exactly what each of us have to do. We have to self-examine and figure out strategies that work for us, that are compatible with our particular makeup. In fact, at the end of the class, I'm going to give you a questionnaire, and you can find out where you fit in Dr. Leaf's framework, the 7 Pillars of Wisdom. And you very quickly, it'll take about half an hour maybe on the test, and you get an idea of where, you know, some of your preferences and the things that you are rather not think about, you know, how not to think. So we'll be doing that between classes. But, okay, so that's something. Now, I was hoping David would be here. David Banda. I was going over the recording of 2 sessions ago, and I remember at the break, he came up and he says, you know, he's an evangelistic person. He teaches it, I think. He says, I talked with a guy, kind of like your atheist friend. He started out, he's an atheist, you know. And I talked with him a little further, and he says, well, you know, I'm not really an atheist. I'm more of an agnostic. And then David talked with him some more, and the fellow says, well, you know, I'm kind of leaning towards deism. So this fellow was kind of fluid. And I think what it amounts to is he hadn't interrogated his own unconscious mind. He hasn't studied it enough and thought about it enough so that he would bring out what his true feelings were at first. And many, many people have beliefs that they can't explain why. It's just in their unconscious mind, and they believe it, and it may be true. And if it's based on sound observations, and this, it could be true as could be, but they can't explain it. And that is a situation that you run into, and that maybe you even yourself have things that you believe, and you can't articulate why you believe it.
Well, if you're brought up believing a certain, like in a certain faith, then you may keep that faith as an adult, and you. Not because it makes any sense, but just because that's the way you were brought up.
Right, exactly. You absorbed and had enough exposure to it that you just thought that's part of life, and your unconscious went along with that. But you can't articulate why, and you haven't really examined it. And there are a lot of people where, in effect, your interaction with them, you're helping them explore their unconscious mind. It's really a helpful kind of thing. All right. So that was, to me, a loose end. I really didn't talk about the unconscious quite as much as I should in the previous session. So that was, to me, a loose end.
Right.
Yes.
I was noting, remember the first class when we asked, you know, what would you say to this person?
Yeah.
Several of us said, you know, how long have you been an atheist? And I think that's a good way to get started.
Yeah, where did it start? Yeah.
You know, because they have something in there.
Yeah.
That made them believe that.
They drifted because that.
It could turn into one of their stories.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Know? Yeah. That's the kind
of
question.
Emotion to it.
Yeah, we'll have a good session on questions, the kind of questions to bring up the second hour. We have a lot on that. So, but let's watch our cold case. Materials from chapter 13. How many had a chance to read chapter 13? Oh, that's good. That's good. It has, I think, really good things in it. So the first thing I have to do is, where's my arrow here? Oh, it moves very fast. Okay, so I have to kill this completely. All right, so we'll do the video first. And then we look at the overheads, which relate to the video. All right, let's hope that comes up. And we'll get the volume. Make sure it's okay.
But I contended that this other issue was bigger for me as a skeptic.
Volume
I didn't trust that they were early, and I didn't trust that they hadn't changed over time. Jesus might be a smart guy, a first century rabbi, but he was not God. And all that miracle stuff, that never happened. That had to be in a certain way. This is the legend of Jesus growing over time. How do I know if that's true or not? Here's a guy we took to jail. We got on Dateline 3 weeks ago on Sunday night. Probably if you saw the show. He killed his wife in 1981. And when he investigated in 1981, he thought it was a missing persons. So he didn't even investigate it as a homicide. For 6 years, it wasn't investigated. There's no casework done on this for 6 years. No crime scene photographed. No single piece of evidence recovered. He moved before we ever started investigating. I go to my property, there's not a single piece of evidence in the property room. So I had to convict him in 4.5 hours. By the way, he did confess to the entire thing in sentence. He did confess to it and gave us location of the body. But how did we do it? Did his story change over time? He said one thing in 81, another thing in 87, another thing in 96, another thing in 2010. If your story is changing over time, there's a good chance I shouldn't trust you. Is the story of Jesus changing over time? Let's go back to our crime scene. Here's our courtroom. How do I know what happened in these 330 years to that document? Let's go to a regular crime scene and a regular courtroom and talk about an analogy there. I'll put a piece of evidence in the crime scene. I'm going to put a case in. You see it? Here's the same case, you know, allegedly, at the courtroom. How do I know that this case was actually at the crime scene? How do I know I haven't tampered with it? Well, one way to do it is check is to say, hey, well, how do I even look at this and know that, say, for example, some evil detective didn't come along 10 years later and drop this into the property? If that happened, it was never at the crime scene, but certainly the property late. Couldn't then somebody following this guy not know any better and work it like real evidence? The next guy comes along, he thinks it's real evidence, he brings it into the courtroom. Now I've got a piece of evidence in my trial that was never even at the scene, or if it was there, it was totally different in terms of its form. Any little extractor mark, anything you're trying to take out of it evidentially, wasn't even part of the original casing. How do I know? Couldn't something similar happen to the Gospel, let's say, of John? Some Gospel is written to John's, or Mark's, or Matthew's, but it's very simple. And then later on, of course, we're going to submit this to the council. This is the allegedly reliable eyewitness account. But how do I know how many times in history, maybe many times in history, somebody either intentionally or unintentionally altered the text until finally, whoever follows them has no idea it's been altered hundreds of times, drops that into the council as though it's the legitimate gospel of whatever, when in fact it's been modified hundreds of times. That was my suspicion all along. Now, I know how to deal with this in crime scenes. It's pretty simple. What you do is you go in and you say, look, is there an officer at the scene back in 1981 who took a picture, a Polaroid, or wrote a really good report in which he describes that piece of evidence? Do you guys even know what a Polaroid is? Let's do the old person count here. How many know what a Polaroid is? Papaya, let's watch this group age in front of your very eyes. How many of you know this kind of Polaroid? There it is, Polaroid. Very good, cool, cool. That includes all of you, no problem. How about this kind of Polaroid? Now you're getting older. How about this kind of Polaroid? Now you're just adding 10 years to your life, and you're older. You feel like you're adding 10 years less watching this stupid demonstration, right? Last one, here we go. Yes, we used to actually put the developing solution on the Polaroid. Those are the 70-year-olds in the audience. They will raise your hand for 70. Okay, so here we go. Do I have a Polaroid or just a good supplemental report where this officer describes completely what he has in the crime scene? That would be helpful. Get a picture of what was actually there. He then gave it to somebody else who took another Polaroid, wrote his own supplemental report, drove it to the crime lab, took the first 35mm film of this thing. Now I got a document, we're examining it, give it back to another guy, he writes a report, he brings it into the courtroom. Now I have many pictures of this piece of evidence over the years, many reports. I can look and see, is it changing over time? This is called the chain of custody. If I have confidence that I can see it over and over and over again and it's not changing, that is helping. Do I have anything like that from the New Testament? Yeah, I think we do. So let's take a look at the New Testament chain of custody together. Crime scene, courtroom. First officer on scene takes a picture of Jesus. Let's call him John in this case. John takes a picture. How do I know what's in his picture? I got to ask, is there another officer who follows John who he gives his picture to? Maybe they'll take a picture of his picture. Wouldn't that be cool? Then I would know if that picture's changed at all. Turns out he has three students. These three students are Ananias, Ignatius, Papias, Polycarp. These guys became leaders in the church in their own right and took a picture of Jesus based on what they were taught by John. Lucky for us, they became leaders because they wrote to the local churches. And Ignatius, for example, wrote 7 letters. Looking at the most redacted forms of these letters, we can get a clear image of the Jesus that he was taught by John. Now, with that, he's going to reference many of the canonical Gospels and letters of Paul in his writings. So don't let him tell you, well, I think that was... Look, the guys at the very first level of chain of custody are talking about these documents. They're referencing these documents. Come on. Papias, unfortunately, we don't have anything left from Papias. We've lost most of his stuff. But Polycarp, here he is. He writes to one church in Philippi, and he also describes Jesus the way he was taught to him by John. It turns out these three also had a student named Irenaeus. Now we're moving down in history. We can look at Irenaeus' work to see if Jesus has changed again, another Polaroid of Jesus. And it turns out that Irenaeus describes the 24 books he considers reliable that he's using to teach his students. One of his students is named Hippolytus, who again writes about Jesus and describes the same 24 books that he considers to be actually some modification of which 24 books. This is now being collected and used. Don't let anyone tell you the canon was affirmed or written late in history. It was affirmed late in history, but used from the very first century on. Now, unfortunately, I can't find somebody after Hippolytus, but look at Paul's chain of custody through First Clement, through the Roman bishopric, to Tatian. It stopped short also. But look at Peter's chain of custody through Mark and the North African bishops and the school at Alexandria. All the way you see is we have many pictures of Jesus, Polaroids, supplemental reports to examine, to compare to one another, to see, is Jesus changing over time? Has the evidence been corrupted? And there are three different locations. They're in Ephesus, I mean Rome, Ephesus, and North Africa. They couldn't just like text each other. Sorry. They couldn't call. Hey, what are you saying about Jesus? No, they had to actually, they were separated by thousands of miles. This is the problem. I think when you see this picture repeatedly, you can have confidence. Because if you lost all of the original documents from the biblical authors, and all you had were the first century chain of custody second officers, and you wanted to build your case for Jesus from just these guys, what would you know about Jesus? I think most skeptics would not be comfortable with this description of Jesus because it's identical to the biblical canonical scripture of Jesus, that description of Jesus we have today. Born of a virgin, taught great sermons, worked miracles, claimed to be God, demonstrated his deity by dying on a cross and rising from the grave, ascending into heaven, through whom in faith alone you are saved. That is the earliest testimony in the chain of custody, written early and repeated often. You're stuck with that form of Jesus.
Yeah.
Very good, I thought.
Yeah.
In his write-up, he emphasizes a couple of things about the culture. These folks were raised in the Jewish culture, and they are meticulous and have been meticulous about recording things mm-hmm. and all that. He didn't mention that. He did mention that in his book, but what he didn't mention in his book is how the Roman culture was the same. They revered history. My wife was watching a travel log on the Middle East, and the person was visiting Ephesus, and he was visiting the library building that was built in about 100 or so, 110 maybe, right in there in Ephesus, one of the largest libraries in the whole world at that time. Only Alexandria or something was bigger. In other words, Romans revered history, and they revered writing things down, in addition to the Jews. So I think the Jews did it first, but the point is, because of the Greek and all that influence. So these folks are embedded in a culture like that. A second thing he didn't overtly say in the textbook, the chapter you read, is the first generation, some of them were tradesmen. I think, you know, they fishermen and tent makers or whatever they were. But a lot of the students were scholars. They wrote books. Some of these folks he mentioned wrote 24 volume, you know, treatise on something. Not 24, I think it was 3. But you know what I mean. The idea, they were the second generation around 100, they were scholars who revere words and revere history and all that stuff. So he said, my chain gets weak here at this one point. It was around the year 100. But the chain is in the possession of scholars. So don't tell me they all of a sudden got sloppy. Okay, you just can't. So there's some really really great things in the chapter. So I'm glad many of you read it. Okay, so let's look at the overheads, which you'll get a copy of tomorrow. Which one is, here we go, this one. How many have signed up for his daily newsletter, J. Warner Wallace's newsletter? I get, if you go to his website, Cold Case Christianity, I'm sorry, I have to kill the other one first. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. Where is this? Where's my arrow? why don't I see my arrow here? I forgot. I have to be sure that that is killed because it takes hold of the video or the audio, you know, the TV set. Okay, now go to this. Yeah, if you go to his website, you can sign up and get a daily shot in the arm from him. Okay, that's the overall structure of the chapters we're looking at. And we just saw the honest accuracy over time. As part of, that's one of the assertions. The reason he has the assertion about the Council of that was in 363... is that many people that attack the Gospels say they were tinkered with and they finally figured out what they said then. And that's absolutely not the case. And he's showing the chain of custody and what happened over time to show that. So, over time. Okay. That's a pictorial of the chain of custody. That's a good thing to remember. And that's, that overhits the pep talk on the what happens in a courtroom and the example he gives about the case he solved. All right. So we're going to ask the same question of the... And here they are. So it's a little bit hard to read, but in... In the textbook, he'll go over each of these folks, and they were writing things and around the year 100. So that's very close in time to when the Gospels were written. John's was towards the end of his life, but that was late, you know, maybe 90 or something. It says in my book when they think it was written. But the point is, these are close in time, and these folks are scholars. So that's the handoff to a generation which is trustworthy. So there's a pictorial of the thing you just went through that's more of the same with more dates on it. All of these dates are in the the book with paragraphs about each of these people and where they were born, where they resided, and what they wrote, and quotes from them that show a direct correspondence to the Gospels. So these overheads are very, very helpful to kind of summarize, or if you were talking with somebody, to remind you of that story, basically, that narrative. And that's very compelling. The fact that the same picture emerges, the same confidence emerges in areas of the world very distant from each other. Those folks can't be communicating very well. You know, they're independently taking care of Scripture because they care about it. And you get the same story from three different regions of the world. And that's a very compelling story, I think. He has a longer list of the characteristics, and I really like the reasoning. He says, let's pretend we lost the Gospels. We don't have any of them. What are these folks, what's the aggregate picture of Jesus and his life and his ministry from these students who heard it from the eyewitnesses? In other words, can you build the same picture? And it really is the essential picture. So that's how thorough the cross-check is. That's a test of how thorough the cross-check is. That it's enough to build, you could have a pretty useful picture of Jesus, even if you didn't have the Gospels. That shows how thorough the cross-check is. Yes, ma'am?
Well, I was wondering when I read this, too, because I don't know if it made it clear that, is that because with all three of these areas, these facts are repeated?
Yes.
They're repeated.
Yes. They said they basically use a quote from Scripture sometimes, or they'll paraphrase, and it's the description. So that gives you confidence that it didn't change. That it's not something that was manufactured late.
Right.
This is around the year 100. Yeah. The assertion is they were tinkering with it till the year 360. That's the assertion that many people make.
But I guess what I'm asking, because I'm still not sure that, like the ones in Northern Africa would have the same facts as the ones from Italy?
Yes.
The same facts?
The same.
Even though they started out with different people, like one was Paul, one was Peter, one was Jesus.
Yes, yes.
Or
yes.
John.
Yeah, John or somebody, yeah. That's the assertion, that these folks were the students of separate disciples, separate eyewitnesses, and that the story they received from their teacher was the story, the whole story. No matter what, where you were, okay, you got the same story. And so, to me, it's extremely compelling.
Was that story just passed on by word, by orally, or rather than written?
Probably
they had,
both.
They had copies of.
Oh yeah, they had copies. Yeah. So
they were almost identical.
Yes.
The copies they
or identical. Yes.
Well, they weren't quite identical.
Yeah. Yeah. There were. I guess there were some discrepancies. But the point is, the essential features never changed from the very beginning. And this is one way of proving it, because if it was something that, or somebody said, you know, this is a little better idea, why don't we tell this particular part of the story a little differently, the other two would disagree, you know, the other two areas of the country. So there was none of that kind of tinkering. That's the assertion is made, that the Gospels evolved and that they finally weren't decided until the year 363. And see how flaky it is, blah, 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 it's built on sand and all these kind of things.
Well, there's some people that even when you present them with all of this evidence for the reliable of reliability of the Gospels, they're still going to claim that they were tinkered with and altered.
Well, do they have evidence? What evidence do they have? I mean, that's a way to talk about evidence. And, well, here's what I know. Here's what I know, and here are the names of the people, and here's where they were born, and here's what they did, and here's what they said. And what do you think? And I think, my guess is Bart Ehrman, he's one of the principal naysayers. Uh-huh. And he's well-schooled in biblical matters and things like that. And he's made a career out of attack mode. And so I personally have not read things he's written, but my suspicion is he has a few or maybe many examples of things. But the fundamental question is, did the essential story change? And in terms of essentials, absolutely not. And it was there from the beginning. And they were eyewitnesses. And that's how they sold it when they went to the marketplace. Peter, when he was there, he preached, I saw this. Paul says, I saw this. And I talked to people who saw things, like what he saw in Damascus, the road to Damascus, that kind of thing. I mean, so anyhow, that's the whole idea.
I'm not sure if I remember correctly, but I think there was some mention of, maybe from the Dead Sea Scrolls or whatever, how many copies there are. You know, compared to the Old Testament, they only have, you know, like the whole book of Isaiah.
Yeah.
But
the fragments.
Well, there were thousands of scrolls that were found in various sundry caves in that whole valley area where the original was discovered. And so there's a whole process that they had to go through in order to match them up. And there were different books, so it wasn't just Isaiah. But Isaiah was the one that I think was the most perfectly preserved.
Yes, complete the book of Isaiah.
Yeah, right. So, but it's quite a story because they actually went through arduous processes to try to get them where they would match with the Old Testament many of the other schools.
I saw a video, it was about an hour long, it was a biblical scholar, and he actually named the numbers of various fragments, and the total is 20,000 for
22,000.
It was 20,000 pieces from different places all around, well, the whole Roman Empire. I mean, basically, the Christianity spread as far as Rome spread and beyond. And so they have all these pieces, and that's what they're numbered. I mean, the people that study these things devote themselves to checking stuff out, you know, checking it out. So there is a video that I saw a long time ago. I looked for it one time, and I just wasn't able to find it again. And it's one of the ones I didn't stay, I didn't save the reference. But it is an enormous volume. There's more on that than any ancient document. I mean, like the works of Homer and various. I've seen some comparisons. If you compare what we have about
Aristotle
and all the various people who we believe we thoroughly understand, and they have like four or eight or some very small number of documents, and to see what did they really say, but the Bible has tons, far more than anything. Yeah, there's some discrepancies, and there's a whole science of how you figure out what's a discrepancy. If you have eight copies of one paragraph and only one has a strange word in it, that's the discrepancy. So, people have gone through to scrub it clean of those kinds of changes.
Does anybody know how many scrolls were actually found among the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yeah, it was approximately 22,000.
22,000? Really?
Yeah, but there are pieces of manuscripts or scrolls, so you can't consider it a whole scroll, but 22,000 is what they have found. And I remember the number because I was struck by it when I was listening or watching the video about the discoveries, and it was astounding that they had so many. And it was, I think it was on the History Channel, if I'm not mistaken, or TBN or one of the other Christian ones. I can't remember for sure, but it was quite an interesting expose.
Now, that might be something worth researching for the next class, is just get an idea and get a reference about that sort of thing. But, we saw the painstaking care that Gary Habermas took to read everything written about the resurrection. Mm-hmm. The last count we had was 3,400 research papers he read concerning analysis of resurrection facts. And he kind of synthesized what they were all saying and what, that kind of thing. Yeah, the scholarship that goes into that sort of thing is amazing. And I'll see if I can find something. But I would invite you to Google it. See what you come up with. You might come up with some real gems.
I heard a story, I don't know, about the Dead Sea Scrolls. I don't know if this is true, but they were discovered by this, I think it was a shepherd boy, and he and his family, they were illiterate, so he brings them home. Mm-hmm. And his mom said, "Oh, I could use these for starting a fire." So she threw one in the fire.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know. I, I'll have to research that. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah. So, well, let's look at some of the objections. He has a few of them here. And one is that some of the folks didn't say things precisely. They were paraphrasing. There are some copyist insertions that are obvious corruptions, and in the book he talks about some of those. But great care is taken to scrub those out. And the people that do that write about it to see what other people think of what they've done and how they've handled it. I mean, there's nothing hidden and secret about it. So that sort of analysis. And he gives an example here on this overhead of an officer getting a call, and there's some mistakes in the calls he gets, but because the dispatches have some commonality, that you can figure out what's the mistake. Like 7-Eleven Market, 7-Eleven Markey. Well, Markey's not right. It's Market, you know, that kind of thing. And descriptions of the handgun, a few words mistaken. You can, basically, that's the way people figure out what's a mistake, or a copyist might try to explain something that they think they know better, maybe, you know. Those are scrubbed, and that's the way they do it. They look at copies from different places and match them up and say, okay, this is the odd one, that must be the wrong one. So, very simple, straightforward kind of things. That some of the narratives differ a little bit, but part of it has to do with the training of the writers. Luke was a medical doctor, and you know, different people have different training, and so they think about things a little bit differently. So, and that's the story there. In one of the earlier videos, he said, or maybe it's in the book, I can't remember, he pointed out, if he has three different witnesses, and they tell precisely exactly the same story with the same words, he knows there's something phony. They collaborated and came up with a story. So, you'd be suspicious if they were identical.
You can take a dozen witnesses to one event, and each witness is going to see something slightly different, and they're going to tell the story differently, because they may have been in a different position, a different perspective is described. So it's interesting. I've done lots of investigations, so I'm somewhat familiar with the process.
Well, I was actually part of a robbery in Encinitas. My family, there were 10 of us, and we were at Chin's restaurant, and it was like a Saturday after Thanksgiving, and in came these guys that were had hoods on and whatever with shotguns and so forth, and held up the restaurant, didn't held up all of us patrons, just the restaurant itself. But we all then, you know, of course the police came, and it was amazing how the 10 of us each had a different version, different pieces that we saw in common and different pieces we saw differently, and to just see how that unfolded.
Did they isolate you?
They talk to us separately,
yeah,
right?
They do that all the time.
Yeah. It was a very interesting process.
Yeah.
And surprising how different. I mean, to the level that one of the people there thought the guys were black, and the rest of us didn't think that. And so it was just really interesting. Also, our previous history has brought into the situation and how we perceive things, and it's really
it's
interesting.
Really interesting. Yeah, we're predisposed to, in many ways that we don't know.
Right.
It's in your unconscious mind, and so it affects how you see things.
Right.
Yeah?
You were going to say something. You were trying to say something?
I think I forgot what it was.
Yeah!
That's okay. It was probably answered.
Okay, so there's a list of what he thinks about these things. the various things. But the big thing is the confirmation of those students from different places, different people, and the summary story, the description of Jesus that emerges in his life and his death and his resurrection. All that, the essential pieces are there from the start. There was no myth building. So there's where we stand. Yeah, we have one more thing. So that's the
whole thought.
We're gonna hold on. We're gonna fill in this last blank with the last element of the four that we're gonna do. So okay, so you'll have these, and why don't we take a break, okay. And then the fun will really start.
What were you gonna say?
And they were talking about how when.